Baseball happened. Let's talk about it. Yankees, Red Sox. We will give it the attention it deserves. The starting pitching situation for the Dodgers gets better, not. And checking in on all the races as the season dwindles down to its final 2 weeks. On this episode of Baseball Barbecast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbecast, the only baseball podcast in the world with the courage to throw up four fingers and admit that we can't face our fears. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And sometimes it takes a big man to admit when they can't handle it, to ask for help.
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting about the intentional walk as a choice, right? Is it asking for help or is it ducking out from it? It's not like you're not really asking for help. You're saying, I don't want to do this. I want to do something else. And I think that the psychology of an intentional walk is something we are going to talk a lot about on this Monday edition of Baseball Barbecast, because Gerrit Cole threw those four fingers up in an act of defiance, an act of fear, an act of aggression, apparently. We are going to get into all of that as the Yankees took 3 of 4 from the Red Sox of Boston over the weekend. We are going to recap all the series, but focus on a few, because with just 2 weeks remaining in the regular season, Jake, some of these series really don't mean a whole lot. So we're going to try and keep our energy focused on the ones that do.
If you want 45 minutes on the Nats taking 3 out of 4 from the Marlins, there are other baseball podcasts for you. Maybe not, actually. I don't know if anyone's doing that.
The Marlins have a lot of... Marlins fan base has a lot. There are a lot of Marlins pods.
Pods are like, I can't talk about this.
Yeah, I'm not sure they watched every single inning of those four games, but who's to say? My brother is already disappointed in Nationals fan David. It's okay. Let's go Yankees-Red Sox, Jake. Let's do it.
Let's sink our teeth into this and let's set the stage, right? Heading into this weekend, the Yankees were looking to really separate themselves from the Orioles atop the AL East. The Red Sox were like kind of in the mix. A hot weekend from them could push them back onto the fringes of the AL wildcard picture. Instead, the Yankees take 3 out of 4 in an exuberant, exhilarating weekend in the Bronx. On Thursday, Nestor Cortez is so good in his start that they let him back into the starting rotation. He had been briefly moved to the bullpen. He was pissed about it. He was good enough that they said, sorry, Marcus Stroman, you are now in the bullpen. On Friday, the Yankees are down 4-1. Aaron Judge, longest homerless streak of his career, hits a grand slam for the ages, the defining moment of this Yankees season so far. A 4-run shot to give them the lead by 1 run over the Red Sox. The place went nuts. Like it was, as I think many people said, 1-4 the DVD. Judge looked back. On Saturday, we had the intentional walk heard around the world. Yankees are up 1-0 in the fourth. Cole gets the first out in the inning. Up walks Devers. He throws up the 4 for the intentional walk. First time I can remember a pitcher doing it himself. Red Sox score 3 in that inning. I think they score 4 in the next inning. Red Sox win that one. It could have turned into something of a landslide. Instead, Yankees come back, win on Sunday. Rodon is very good. Okay, and so now the takeaway from this series, and we'll jump right to that, is that the Red Sox are probably done. They're 4.5 back with 2 weeks to play and 2 teams between them and a spot. And the Yankees, 3 games up over the stinky poo-poo Orioles, seem like they have one hand on the... more on them later. Seems like the Yankees have one hand on the AL East banner.
Yeah, I think that the Judge homer, the grand slam, his 52nd home run of the year, his homers again Sunday, 53rd. It was just like a huge sigh of relief for the whole team. I think it was like, once Aaron Judge remembers how to hit home runs, now it's like, oh, okay. And then immediately he homers again yesterday. And it's like, oh, okay, everybody's going to be, you know, unanimous MVP again. And very well possible, right? I got on here on Friday and I was like, man, this guy still isn't homering. because he doesn't have his lucky bat anymore, as we know. It's shattered. Thanks to that Speedmeister sinker. But he, whatever bat he's using now, whether it's lucky or not, whether it's from his friends with the Rebel and crew or not, he found the right piece of lumber. And now, granted, the pitch, you know, but you know, and I'm not even going to do that. You make your money hitting the. I know everyone's like, every single Aaron Judge home run is a fastball right down the middle. No, but also, not the best pitch to Aaron Judge. But either way, he made it happen in that spot. He hit the go ahead grand slam down by three, and like I said, it just felt like it was a sigh of relief for the whole team, and I felt like that was how they showed for most of the weekend, except for Saturday, which we should certainly get into.
Aaron Judge is a man with many superpowers. He is very tall. When you stand next to Aaron Judge, the sheer shape and size of the man feels superhuman in and of itself, as is his rotational power, as is his arm, which we don't really talk about enough, as is the fact that he's not just some DH. He's not a great center fielder, but he's a good corner outfielder, right? And he's that tall and that big. But his superpower as the captain of the Yankees is that he never freaks out. He never looks panicked. He never slams a helmet or shoves a bat firmly into a bat rack. He never looks perturbed during a press conference. Like, that to me is the jitteriness of it all. And it is both eye-rolly, and when you have the amount of eyeballs that he has on Yankee world and Aaron Judge world, it's important. And it, because the rest of the team feeds off of that. And during this rough stretch, he never looked sped up. He never looked worried or bothered. And he has this look. I've talked about this before. The smile, the Aaron Judge grin that conveys he knows something that you don't. That there is an, and to me, that thing that he knows that we don't is that he's going to be okay. That the Yankees are going to be okay. Now, often they are not okay. Usually Aaron Judge is okay, right? And so whenever he has the moment, the type of moment that he does on Friday, and then he does the press conference, and he has this look on his face, it's like, I'm still Aaron Judge. You were all worried, and I was not. And I am impressed by that, not as much as the 500-foot home runs, but I am very impressed by it.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think that that kind of steadying reminder has been is valuable for sure. Now, that said, again, good weekend for the Yankees for sure. I think that their pitching situation quickly on the Nestor choice, as we understand, Stroman versus Nestor. I mean, yeah, I think both of them have just been not the version that they were hoping for a lot of this, certainly for the last couple of months, but they had to kind of decide on one of them. And whether either of them is definitely going to start a postseason game is, I think, TBD based on how the schedule plays out. But the point is, it's good that this was an example where, I mean, I would love to know what our producer feels about this, our Yankees fan producer, Andrew Harris, feels about this, but it's just like they weren't going to keep giving it to Stroman because, you know, they were paying him whatever they're paying him. And obviously they have loyalty to Nestor as well. But as we've seen across the league, you're going to have to make some of these, you know, decisions about these rotations. And I think that is an interesting one. We'll see how it plays out. Obviously, Nestor still has to continue to pitch better because he hasn't exactly strung together like four or five good starts in a row much this season. So that is going to be important. But yeah,
very quickly on Nestor. Mm-hmm. He has a 3.11 ERA at home and a 4.81 on the road. And so if you can find a way to get him his starts at home, he's proven for whatever reason that he's significantly better at home. And then he throws with his left arm.
Right.
And Marcus Stroman does not throw with his left arm, or at least he probably shouldn't because he's a righty. And so that, I think, is important to remember as well.
Totally. But the last thing on that is I am curious about Stroman in the bullpen. What does that look like? What roles are they using him in? Because that's the kind of guy where it's like, does it still make sense to have him on? Like, I imagine it's certainly in a DS, he's going to be on the roster in some form, but I don't really know what spots, like in theory, like, okay, come in and get a ground ball. Right. But it is an interesting role to see him in. And
remember, I'm curious the Cubs used him out of the bullpen last September, and it was kind of a catastrophe.
Yeah. So we'll see how that goes, but not the most important thing. I'm much more interested in Gerrit Cole, right? So also as a pitcher too, because Gerrit Cole, what beyond the intentional walk is just an interesting outing because of how it ultimately transpired, because he's rolling, right? It's like, all right, great. Gerrit Cole, here we go. And he's kind of alternated good and bad starts over the last.
No, he is not.
No, he is not.
Gerrit Cole has been Gerrit Cole for about a month and change now.
He's still walking a lot of guys.
Walking too many hitters.
Okay.
I agree.
Which is different.
Which is different. Over a 7-start stretch from the beginning of August before this past weekend, he had a 1.58.
Okay. Okay.
In 40 innings with 47 strikeouts. It more walks than you like. 12 over 40, even for him. He had a 5-walk start at one point.
Okay. Sorry. I was thinking that was more recently. Yep.
He looked like Gerrit Cole. He has looked like Gerrit Cole. And coming off the IL, it's important to remember, he was basically rehabbing at the big league level. All of his scuffles in June and July, I take with a big grain of salt. And so when he's rolling into the fourth inning, it's like, oh, well, this is just another good start for Gerrit Cole. Okay. That's one fact that we hold in our heads. The other is that Rafael Devers dominates Gerrit Cole. 8 home runs against him. Last week, Gerrit Cole was asked at a press conference, I believe it was, which Latin hitter impresses you the most, it was not fear the most. He would not answer that question, but, and he answered Rafi Devers, which is the correct answer.
Yeah. He's been open about, like, this has not been a secret. Like, he has talked about it. He has in both, like, genuine moments of exasperation and frustration, but also in moments of admiration and respect. And like laughing, like, yeah, that guy owns me, right? Like, there's versions of that in the league, and this was one of the most prominent ones,
including these past 3 plate appearances. Devers is 14 for 40 against him, with a 14.10 OPS and 8 home runs.
A lot of Cole has led
8 home runs to him. The next most homers against Cole is 4. That's Matt Carpenter, Joey Gallo, and Lucas Duda, which is so good. Lucas Duda, 4 homers and 14 plate appearances against Cole, which is hilarious. So you understand why Cole would try for a different approach against Devers. But when he throws up the 4 himself and gestures towards first base for Devers to take his intentional walk, everyone is perplexed and confused, given the situation. Yankees up a run, nobody on base, and 1 out. Mostly for me, as someone who's watching this game live, to see the pitcher throw up the intentional walk sign, it feels unprecedented.
Yeah.
Usually, the manager is the one doing this. And one of my major takeaways of this whole thing is there's a reason why the manager is the one making these decisions. Because when it goes sideways, like it did over the weekend, Aaron Boone can just eat it.
Puts everyone in a bad position. Because then you got to go to Austin Wells and be like, hey, Austin Wells, the catcher, what the heck, man?
Right.
You know, were you on the same pitch? And Austin Wells basically admitted, like, I was caught off guard.
So I just want to just create this alternate timeline. If Boone is the one who throws up the 4, let's say even Cole like wants to walk him. He's afraid of Devers. He doesn't want to face him. Boone throws up the 4. He walks him. In the postgame, Cole says, you know, that's what Aaron thought was the right move. I trust my manager. Devers has obviously had a lot of success against me. Kind of an abnormal place to do it, but it was Aaron's call. Even if it was Garrett's. That is literally Aaron Boone's job.
Which could have been a very, reasonable timeline.
And if that's the case, we have no narrative here about Gerrit Cole being a fraidy cat or a coward.
No, it's just like whatever. Aaron Boone. Oh, Aaron Boone, you didn't
overmanage.
It's more about Aaron Boone didn't trust Gerrit Cole, right? And then it's just another thing that Boone has to deal with, but that's not necessarily new.
That doesn't matter because behind the scenes, Boone and Cole are fine, and like whatever is happening on the outside doesn't actually, impact what's going on. It doesn't matter. Instead, Cole is the one who throws it up. And that, I think, is why this exploded into what it turned into, because then it becomes, is Gerrit Cole one of the best 5 pitchers on the planet, probably the best pitcher over the last half decade in Major League Baseball? Is he afraid? Is he passive?
Well, this is where, and I want to get to what Cole ended up having to say after the game, because that's super interesting. But it's not just that Gerrit Cole wanted to intentionally walk Aaron Judge or Rafael Devers. That, okay, that by itself is worthy of, and that he decided to do it is fine. However, the game situation is so relevant here. Okay. Bases empty intentional walks on their own are already exceptionally rare. It had happened 5 times this season before this, all of which, 3 of them were Aaron Judge. Okay. 2 of them, the other 2 were Vlad Jr. and Yordan Alvarez. In all of those games, the team that did it was losing by it, and it was later in the game. 4 of them were, it was later in the game. Okay. In all of those times, the team that intentionally walked the batter with the bases empty, they were losing. So this in this case, that you had Gerrit Cole deciding to put the tying run on base in the middle of the game in a start in which he was already succeeding. And that's another thing Austin Wells said after the game, like, yeah, like he was rolling. And then after that, you know, it kind of unraveled. And what he talked about is, you know, whatever the concept of momentum, you can roll your eyes or not. He said, what Austin Wells said was he didn't think that Gerrit himself was rattled after that he rattled himself, but it did feel like it absolutely gave the Red Sox a sense of, oh, okay, he's scared. We sense that he's scared and now we can start hitting. And so that, and obviously that's what ends up happening. And so that, but the game situation is very relevant here because, and then looking back last year, it only happened 3 times. It was Judge, it was Ohtani, it was Harper. Ohtani is the most comparable one. The Mariners intentionally walked him with the bases empty and when they were winning, like in a 1-run game. But like there's versions of this we've seen, but it's so rare. So that's where it is. If he had intentionally walked Devers in a more normal intentional walk situation later in the game, not as big of a story. It's just not.
So I went to, shouts out to Baseball Reference, Stathead is amazing, the pitching event finder. Here's what I plugged in. I understand a lot of levers, but just follow with me. First, second, third, fourth, fifth inning, early in the game. Team up by any amount of runs. Intentional walk, bases empty. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Intentional walk, bases empty. Win, the team on the mound is winning early in the game. Starting pitcher. Okay. This is since 2000. Mm-hmm. This is the 4th one.
Yeah.
Okay. 4th. The other 3, Barry Bonds. 2 of those were in the same game, which is unbelievable. That Carl Pavano basically intentionally walked Barry Bonds twice with the bases empty while winning in 2004. Duh. But the point here is that I think we're trying to get across with all these numbers. This is such a bizarre move for any pitcher to make to any hitter in this spot. And so beyond, was it cowardice or was it fear? It was unwise. Hmm. Right. And I think that
the very
is
least
is
unusual. And the that's why I do unusual. Think at the that's why I do think if Boone had made that decision, it would have been a just talking point as a managerial move because it is so rare. So I think in that sense, it is worth hitting. But obviously, the bigger story here is Cole's decision.
And I think that's what I want to end on. After the game, Gerrit Cole is very specific in his word choice, saying that this was an aggressive decision to aggressively intentionally walk someone, which is, I mean, that's top of the charts
but
spin
I,
zone right
yes,
there.
Yes, but
love
I think
it.
I know what he's getting at, but continue.
I do too, but it's like saying, oh, it's, you know, I don't want to go to work. I'm going to aggressively stay in bed all day. You know, like you could just throw aggressively really in front of anything you want. Mm-hmm. I'm going to aggressively break up with this person by text. Like
or by stopping to talk to them.
Right. I'm gonna aggressively ghost them.
Right. Yeah. So do you want to read the quote? Because then I do think
read the quote, but the question I want to just have linger over us while we finish this. Does this change the way you think about Gerrit Cole? So I just think about that and read the quote.
So, just to be clear here, because I'm just on the dock, the first quote is from who? Is from Boone?
Yeah.
The first quote is from Boone. Okay, and then the second quote is from Gerrit. Okay. So Boone said, I think this is lends some credence to my theory here. Boone said, working through preparation this week with Garrett, we were going to be a little more aggressive in some situations. Okay, so that's what Boone says.
Again, I think that's again, that's not what aggressive is.
But I think that nobody's
the word is
at.
Yeah. Different. We are going to operate in a different fashion.
Okay, so right, and we're getting to that. And then this
which
is
I
what,
guess is aggression.
This is what Cole said. We were in the tunnel before the inning, and I discussed that if Duran was retired, we were going to stick to aggressively, intentionally walk him, and that was the plan. Oh, were we going to stick to aggressively, intentionally walk him? And that was the plan. And then during the inning, I looked to the dugout and stuck with the plan. If I make pitches after that and I continue to execute at a high level, the plan works, but evidently the plan didn't work.
That's an important takeaway. Remember, if he gets these guys out, we're not talking about it now. It's that he allowed 3 runs and looked out of sorts, and then they scored 4 in the next inning. Devers got a hit off of him, RBI. Right. Like, that's why we're talking about this. I am going to now answer my own question. This does not at all change the way that I think about Gerrit Cole. Not really at all. Being around Gerrit Cole for the last couple of years here in New York, being in the clubhouse, seeing him operate, speaking with him many times, Gerrit Cole is an honest person. Mm-hmm. Very honest. He thinks about his responses. I give him a lot of credit for that, right? Sometimes he's too honest. I think that this is one of those times that Gerrit Cole even felt confident enough to intentionally walk a batter is indicative that he thinks he is that dude still. No, duh. He was intimidated or impacted, afraid is probably too strong, of Devers enough in this situation to walk him, yes. But he was not afraid of any blowback from how this would go. And to me, maybe I'm spin zoning this myself. To me, that makes me think Gerrit Cole is still that guy. He's still a boss, right? He is willing to wear the response to this in a way that very few other pitchers would. Now, I think a lot of other pitchers would do something along the lines of, "Ah, I'm a dog. I face my fears," right? Like, and yes, well, that's a part of pitching.
Yeah,
I agree. Sure. Like, being dominant and being irrationally self-confident is the reason why I, you know, me as a bad D3 pitcher, that's why I figured it out, because I just started believing that I was really good. And then you fall into that, right? Mm-hmm. Still, I think Cole, this doesn't change any of what I think about Gerrit Cole.
No, personally. No, I'm with you on. I would just say I would leave it with the two words that we keep using. First of all, I think he put the intentional in intentional walk. Like, he thought about this a lot. And I think that's the takeaway here, is like, Devers clearly, with both the data and I guess mentally, was in his head. For better or for worse, he had been thinking, is there a situation, like, it got to the point where he was considering this, which is not a matter of cowardice. It was a matter of an intentional decision that I trust myself, to your point, to get the other guys out so that it is smarter for me to not try and get this guy out. If you want to say that's cowardice, that's fine. But it was clearly an intentionally intentional choice. Okay.
If this had been done by a number of other pitchers in baseball, I would feel differently. Gerrit Cole's track record,
sure,
and reputation is enough that it shouldn't alter too much. Yesterday on the Mets broadcast, like, Keith Hernandez, he didn't know, and they were telling him the story, and Keith was like, "What has it come to? Like, what is it?" And it's like, yeah, I think you could say that. I do think there's an element of, like, you should face the guy,
yes,
and try and get past it if you are the ace. Sure. But that's if this was a 25-year-old burgeoning star, that's one thing. Gerrit Cole's a Hall of Famer. Yeah. Like, if he sucks for the rest of the year and gets crushed in the playoffs, I will revisit this theory.
I still think this is a story about Rafael Devers. Like, to me, this is a very singular situation that had somehow managed to get Gerrit Cole to think this way, which I think is interesting on its own.
And at the end of the day, what is more relatable than saying, "I don't want to deal with that right now"? This is procrastination from a professional athlete.
Yeah.
And all of us normies just have to tip our caps. All right, let's take a quick break. And when we return, we will talk about the 28 other baseball.
We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It was a weird, rough weekend for Gerrit Cole. However, you know who would love to have Gerrit Cole? Would be the Los Angeles Dodgers, who need anything resembling a starting pitcher. LA went into Atlanta this weekend for a four-game set that continues today against the Braves. And in those first two games, their starting pitchers got crushed. In the first game, Landon Knack went two innings and allowed five runs. Game two, Jack Flaherty, the big deadline acquisition, struggled through three innings, allowing four runs. Dodgers lost both of those games. But the bigger news came on Saturday when Tyler Glasnow, who was one of the best pitchers in baseball in the first half, has been out with elbow discomfort for a little while in preparing for a simulated game to make his way back, felt discomfort in that same elbow, and it was revealed that he has a sprained elbow and is unlikely to pitch the rest of the season. Very quickly, I'm just going to summarize. Dodgers win on Sunday. They take that game from the Braves. Big weekend for the Braves taking those first two games. Atlanta is tied for the NL wildcard spot. Cool. We'll talk about that a bit later when we get to the Mets. Just want to focus on the Dodgers starting pitching woes for a second.
Yeah. And obviously good for them last night, scoring the billion runs against Raisel Iglesias. That's like his worst outing, not just in months, but in years. So it's a good reminder that now, and I say that to kind of mention that the Dodgers are now entering a bit of an extreme situation for not just their pitching, but also offensively, that they are now going to probably have to basically just outscore everybody in games that at least Yoshinobu Yamamoto is not on the mound. But I would say Flaherty had generally been very good for them, and he's someone, at least durability-wise, I know it sounds weird saying about him, but so far, you know, this year, he has been pretty healthy, and I think they're going to trust him. But with Yamamoto coming back, who looked great, but in a shorter stint, we'll see how he kind of eases back into it. But man, I mean, counting on Glasnow to come back, which I guess we weren't necessarily doing, but like that was something that we were already heading into an unprecedented. We knew this. I mean, Glasnow nearly set his career high in innings in a single season before the All-Star break. I mean, he was on pace to do that, which seemed like a good sign. And now here we are again. And it's a huge bummer. Obviously, we love watching Glasnow pitch. And I know he kind of dipped out this weekend and hasn't spoken to reporters yet, which I know some people in the media are frustrated about, but like, listen, if you're in his, it's an extremely, extremely tough spot for him. I'm sure we will hear from him at some point, but I mean, with Kershaw out, he's dealing with a toe issue, which is kind of oddly cruel when you consider all the things that Clayton Kershaw has dealt with. And now it's a toe that is keeping him off the mound.
Did you see the clip of him throwing a bullpen on Sunday Night Baseball last night?
I did not.
In the sleeveless cutoff?
No, I did not.
Kersh is yoked right
now. He's a big boy. Yeah.
No. He has always been a tall boy.
Oh, you think he's like more jacked than ever? Is that what you're saying?
100,000%. Okay. Like, keep talking and I will send you this picture and it will change everything you think about Clayton Kershaw.
So interesting. I don't know if I've ever thought too much about his physique. It's not like he's ever been skinny. I mean, or not as a longtime big leaguer. I've never thought about him as like particularly muscular. So I guess maybe you're onto something there. But anyway, as he still sits on the IL, we know we've already lost now. Gavin Stone is a big one. He was such a big part for them. And now we're looking at Flaherty, Bueller, and this is where Bueller and Bobby Miller are just so fascinating. Two guys that there was a lot of excitement about coming into this season because Bueller was coming back and Bobby Miller was building off a season where it was like, great, sky's the limit. This guy's throwing 100. He's got nasty stuff and he has been downright dreadful, but they haven't had a choice as to keep rolling him out there in a starting fashion. And let's say that these four guys stay in. Like, I just don't know what the plan is for starting game three. Because at this point, if we're just granting them health, which there's no reason to do at this point, there's no reason to assume all the guys that are currently healthy are going to stay healthy, because that's just what the facts that we're dealing with. I mean, Yamamoto, I trust. If he's healthy, I think he is the real deal. I think what he looked like the other day, what he looked like in the months leading up to his injury, he was proving himself as one of the best pitchers in Major League Baseball. So that's great. That's still something that a lot of teams don't have. But it's just a lot of innings to cover. It is a lot of innings to cover. But I do believe that at their best, they have the best lineup in the league comfortably. And so it's possible that they will be able to outscore everyone and just win games all the way to the World Series 8-5. But that is going to be a treacherous road, and a especially for Dave Roberts to have to literally manage over the course of October.
So I think what's so fascinating about the Dodgers is that they've done this before. This has happened again. And I am willing to accept that the Dodgers front office is one of the more intelligent and skilled groups in baseball. However, the same thing is happening to them as happened last year, where they just don't have enough healthy pitchers at the right important time of the season. And I'm curious to see how or what they change about their process moving forward. Because rolling into the postseason with Landon Knack starting a game four with bullpen day, that should not happen to a team like this. And you know, it reached a certain point because over the weekend, Dave Roberts was like, you know, Shohei Ohtani plays for us and he pitches sometimes and he could pitch for us. And there's no way in my mind that they say that, that they float that if they have five healthy starters. There's no chance, right? Like, no way. And so I am legitimately concerned about the Dodgers pitching. Look, they could go out in a DS and just bludgeon somebody into submission. Well, like they, okay, let's say they play the Brewers, right? In the DS. Yeah. The Brewers starting pitching is relatively. I know it's been better than LA's, but.
Yeah, no, I know. Sure.
But you could easily foresee a scenario where, you know, Shohei Ohtani takes Aaron Civale behind the woodshed.
Well, and this is the thing, is the team that they rolled in, you know, to the postseason with last year, offensively, right? It was JD Martinez instead of Ohtani. But then after that, right?
There's no kind of a big difference.
Well, no, I'm saying that as a it's not nobody at DH. Like JD was pretty good. But the lineup that they're rolling out right now that has, you know, you have the big three, and then it still goes Teoscar, Muncy, Tommy Edman, who looks fantastic, and then Will Smith batting seventh. I mean, that's still as good. That's as good as you're going to see in the whole league. So they are going to roll in with a larger margin for error, just in terms of a run production standpoint. Now, as we've seen, people point out in these smaller series, these great lineups could just disappear for three games, and then you could be eliminated. That's obviously still in play, for sure. But I still have to say on paper that this still looks like an offense that can outscore basically anybody. The other point, I know Andy McCullough made this point on his podcast last week, is, okay, great. So you're worried about your starting pitching? Well, I'm worried about the opposing team starting pitching against this lineup. And so you're basically going to be forcing the other team to churn through their pitching staff in the same way. Like, how many pitchers are you expecting to carve through this group? It's possible. It's very well will happen probably at some point during October. But that's part of it that I think at this point they have to bank on. They don't have a choice. I would say it's not like this was plan A, but they still have this backup plan, which is having maybe the best lineup in the league.
I'm more worried about their pitchers than I am worried about the other teams. I get what Andy's saying, but like, the Spencer Schwellenbach just kicked their ass. You know?
Yeah. It's pretty good. Certainly did. No, I know. Sale
would kick everyone's ass. All right, let's move on from the Dodgers and let's handicap the final 2 weeks of this season. Bit of a different Monday recap show just because of where we're at in the season. And as we have really four series, every team has four series left. Some have, I think, 13 games, some have 12, but everyone really has four series left. And we'll begin with the NL wild card picture.
Yes. Let's stick with the
San Diego Padres. The San Diego Padres have a 3.5 game lead on that first spot. Padres are also three and a half back of the Dodgers for the division. However, the Dodgers have three against Miami and I think six against the Rockies. And so
they play the Padres three more times.
Yes.
So we'll have a glimmer of this could get interesting again, as we've had a couple times over the last couple of months. But for now, still a pretty big gap.
The Padres, they swept the Giants in San Francisco. Very impressive showing. They feel like pretty sturdy to take that top wildcard spot right now. I'm going to push them to side. Arizona, they lose 2 out of 3 at home against the Brewers, winning the drunkest game of the year. I don't want to get bogged down in it quite yet, but go watch the highlights. It was outrageous. They're 1.5 games behind the Padres. And two games up over that final wildcard spot, which is a tie between the Braves and the Mets. The Braves, who took 2 out of 3 from the Dodgers, one more today. And the Mets, who lost 2 out of 3 against the Phillies in Philadelphia, despite carrying a lead into the 7th inning in all 3 games. The Mets clobber Aaron Nola for 2 3-run home runs in the same inning on Friday, win that game. The vibes are good. Lindor's back's bothering him. He sits out on Saturday. It's not that big of a deal. He just needs some rest. My back hurts all the time, too. Luis Severino, outstanding in that one. Early solo shot to Bryce Harper, his first home run in a month. And then one of the bigger swings of this series, Harper 2-run shot off Severino, who had only allowed 2 hits to the Phillies all game long. That cuts the lead to 1. And then the Phillies, C team takes over with Cal Stevenson go-ahead RBI. Then he robs a home run. Phillies win by 1. On Sunday, David Peterson is dynamite. He's up 1-0, pitching into the 8th. Back-to-back doubles from Weston Wilson and Buddy Kennedy, who went to high school, same high school as Mike Trout. Phillies tie the game. JT Realmuto walk-off single in the 9th inning off Edwin Diaz. Phillies take 2 out of 3 over the Mets. Their magic number is 6. They are likely to clinch this weekend in New York, so that is something to keep an eye on. Let's talk about the Mets. The one big thing I barely mentioned is Francisco Lindor's back. It seems that sitting in child's pose for 15 minutes will not loosen it up. Trust me, I've tried. And on Sunday, he starts. He singles to lead off the game. He crawls to first base, basically. Looks uncomfortable. Makes a throw to first in the next inning. Does not look good. Is removed for Luis Angel Acuña, Ronald's brother, who debuted this weekend. That was kind of fun. But the question now is, do the Mets have Francisco Lindor?
Yeah. He'd been carrying them for apparently a little bit too long, as that back is starting to hurt. And this is important because the Mets' big challenge, and we'd kind of pointed this out, and as well as they'd been playing, it's a tough schedule here. And as well as you're playing, you can't afford to drop any of these games if you are going to beat out the Braves here. And when you still have 4 more games against the Phillies and those 3 games at the Braves, which is both a challenge and an opportunity.
And the final 3 are against the Brewers.
Who, the one thing about that is, will the Brewers be playing for anything at that point? That's TBD. I mean, they'll have the division locked up for sure. Seeding might matter. We'll see. Their other 3 games are against the Nats. But, not having Lindor for any amount of time here is just, again, every game is the most important game in multiple seasons at this point. So I don't know. I mean, at this point, it's hard to imagine them putting him on the IL unless it's truly really, really, really bad, just because that would obviously keep him out. And they have a deeper bench, so they can afford to go day to day with this. Cleveland's dealing with this with Stephen Kwan right now. Very similar thing where, you know, you call up someone to just as a fill in, but you don't want to put them on the IL yet. It's massive. And maybe we'll have more news about that today. Are they playing today or are they off today?
They're playing today. The Mets are playing today.
Right. So they have the Nats. So the Nats are this week. So maybe, again, this really isn't how you should be handling it. Maybe you say, okay, it's the Nats. Lindor, take a rest. Probably not the best idea, but also you don't want it to get worse, obviously, if you want him to be playing in October or anything like that. So this is delicate. This is unfortunate. It's another injury that is horribly poorly timed for obviously the Mets, but also as neutrals who want to see this be a genuine, you know, push down to the end. And I'm sure Braves fans are like, oh no, you lost Lindor for 2 games. Oh, we feel so bad. Like, I guess I totally get that. I know, but still, it sucks.
And the Braves have the Reds and the Marlins this week before that showdown with the Mets. Mm-hmm. If you're the Mets, if you're 2 back going into that series, I think that it has to be 2 back or better.
Yeah.
Right? I think if yes, you want it to be tied or you're up, but I think if you go into that final series with the Braves 1 game or 2 games back, that's fine. Obviously, the Mets need to win that final series. Like, that final series is so big because it's also the tiebreaker between these 2 teams. And so whoever wins it's like a double plus good bonus.
Yep.
Let's move on to the AL wildcard situation. That's sure. really the NL. So the Phillies are going to win the division soon. The Brewers could win it today, I believe.
Really?
Or, sorry, I mean, no, tomorrow. They can win it tomorrow.
Yeah.
So their magic number,
they'll be the first one. Man, again, like, yeah. the notion that the Brewers being the first team to clinch a division is yeah. is really, so, really something.
I know you had Kurt Hogg on the pod. I just want to very briefly say, the Brewers being this good is both fascinating and not that complicated. Like, Jackson Chourio is amazing. Willy yeah. Adames is amazing. And William Contreras, yeah. they're all amazing. Like, those yeah. are three legitimately outstanding players.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And no one sucks on that team. And so that's...
Yep.
I know it's more than that, but it's also not.
In that division, that gets the job done, for sure.
Let's move over to the American League side. The Baltimore... They are 4.5 games up for that first wildcard spot. They lost 2 out of 3 over the weekend. The Royals have the second. They're 2.5 up. And then the last spot belongs to the Minnesota Twins, who lost 2 out of 3 over the weekend against the Reds. Behind them, 2.5 games, the Detroit Tigers, also at 2.5 back, the Seattle Mariners. That is where it stands right now. The Orioles, as we mentioned, are 3 back in the AL East. I think that's going to be too much of a gap for them to close. Those two teams play 3 more times, the penultimate series of the year here in New York. If the Orioles win that, if they keep it within 2, they'll have a chance. I still think the Yankees end up winning the division. But let's zoom in on that final AL wildcard spot, which now is coming down to the Twins, the Tigers, and the Mariners.
Mm. So the Twins were really kind of going through it recently, to the point where, you know, after being swept by Kansas City and passed by Kansas City, and Kansas City has just played better. I know they dropped a game against Pittsburgh yesterday, but now it's the Twins that are kind of fending off these late pushes from Detroit and Seattle. Detroit's been playing well for 2 months. I mean, they've been one of the best teams in baseball in the second half. Whereas Seattle just suddenly remembered the stakes of the season and have had 3 of their best wins of the year over the last 3 days, taking 3 of 4 against Texas in that series. But the Twins own the tiebreaker over both teams, I believe, which means definitely over Seattle. We could check against Detroit. But that's important because, remember, we're not having games 163. So while you look at it and you say, oh, 2.5 games, it's really 3.5 games, because if they all finish tied, or if 2 of them finish tied, then Minnesota will end up advancing and clinching that third spot, and makes it a tougher, you know, uphill battle for both Detroit and for Seattle. Now, Detroit showing, again, they are winning against good teams regularly, and they are a very interesting group right now where it's Tarek Skubal, and they are just shuffling through all kinds of pitchers, are getting starts and opens, but they have a lot of really good relievers, and enough of their young hitters that they've called up over the last couple of months have been performing. And someone who we already knew, I think, was pretty good, and Cary Carpenter, you know, he keeps on chugging. He's legitimately good. Riley Green, of course, has been good all season. So it's all kind of coming together. I think narratively the Tigers compel me, just because they are, on one hand, it's like, they are the team with the longest postseason drought in baseball, tied with the Angels. And so them making a push for the postseason is a huge deal. It's just that simple fact.
Yeah.
However, because they had already made progress last year towards this, and because we did have some expectations for them to take another step forward this year, and more importantly, because the Royals are now at 98% playoff probability after losing 106 games last year, the Royals have just usurped them as the story in the division. And so it's hard to focus on Detroit.
My brain can't hold those two things at the same time. I can't have two surprise AL Central teams.
We talked about these teams together coming into the season, and the Royals just ultimately won out. I think they are clearly the better team. I think they're still a team in position to legitimately make some noise in October as well. And so that sorry, Tigers fans, like, again, it is still really impressive how well they've played for so long, and certainly makes me feel a lot better about them going into next season, and primes them to be very relevant this offseason as well. But it is still, even 2.5 games, it's going to be tough.
Tigers do have 3 left against the Chicago Terrible Sox. Let's quickly touch on the Mariners, who took 3 out of 4 over the weekend from the Rangers after losing the first one, winning the last 3 in a row. Offense is finally waking up. Yeah. Will the Mariners raise another finished one game out of the playoffs banner?
I think they will. I think going into this homestand with Texas, Who did they just play last week? Well, the Padres. They had the Padres briefly, and then Texas, and then the Yankees. Going into this homestand, it was like, okay, either they are going to just roll over on this homestand and the season will be over and they'll be eliminated before the final week and that'll be that. Or they'll play well enough in this homestand that they push it into interesting territory in the final week, which includes going to the Astros, right? That's the thing, is the Mariners, as we looked at it, have a path to the division in a way that the Tigers do not, in a way that, you know, some of these other wildcard teams in the National League do not, right? The problem is that the Astros just swept the Angels and are also playing very well. So even as the Mariners have picked up their performance, it's going to be harder to get there. And they probably still need to stay scoreboard watching on Minnesota more than anything. Like we've said about some of these other situations, as you mentioned with Baltimore and New York, they do have those three games against Houston. If they can keep it close within three games going to Houston, maybe they make that interesting. They are playing much better, and the pitching continues to be incredible. They faced the minimum yesterday. Brian Wu and Kirby and all these guys continue to be marvelous. And this outfield is now on fire. Julio looks as good as he's had all season. Randy's finally heating up. Robles, one of the stories of the season. Just, it is starting to click offensively, and this is what it was supposed to look like, but it's probably too late. So it's really that simple.
Nuclear overreaction. Julio Rodriguez needs to play a full season of winter ball every year so that when April starts, brain thinks it's August, and then he's just hot the whole year.
I mean, this is what it looked like last August, is what he's doing right now. But unfortunately, it is probably too late. But they are now wearing the City Connects every game. 15-1 in the City Connect jerseys this year, which is why I'm wearing the hat today. But I mean, you know, I guess it's fun to see what it was supposed to look like, and also just, you know, maddening. So
Julio Rodriguez and the Seattle Mariners, shouts out to JoJo. It is just too little too late. Let's take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll speed through. Sorry for your mentions. Talk about the White Sox winning twice and throw it all into turbo mode. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. The Baltimore Orioles have not won a series against a team currently over 500 since July 4th. And that team was the Seattle Mariners, who are, you know, the least over 500 vibe-wise.
Yeah, especially back then. That was when it was all really going bad. So they haven't beat, as you mentioned, haven't beat a good team in a long time. You tweeted this out, and I love that everyone was responding to us being like, oh, was this guy crapping on the Orioles? I'm like, trust me, you don't got to tell Jake.
It's okay. Do you know, since that date, since July 4th, okay?
Yeah.
America's birthday, when the O's beat the Mariners.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you know where the Orioles rank in MLB in runs scored?
Oh, runs scored. I mean, no, but I'm going to guess like 23rd.
18th, yeah. 18th.
Okay. But again, that's still bad for a team that was one of the best lineups in baseball for the first multiple months.
And they straight up haven't been. And so many of those runs are just Anthony Santander hitting solo shots, right? Like Gunnar went cold. He was heating up over the weekend. Yeah. Adley looked a little better. He has just been pretty brutal now for a couple months. But I wanted to boot up the sorry for your mentions machine. The Orioles dropped the finale on Sunday to the Detroit Tigers. And we had some absolute bangers in the mentions. One of them is from Drew. When is the last time this team won a series against a team over 500? Great question, Drew. It was July 4th.
Guess he doesn't follow us.
Seth says, but what a trade deadline it was.
I mean, yeah.
What it was. That's... Jeffrey says, extra BP for everyone. Tomorrow at noon, be prepared to be there a while. This is a great theme, and sorry for your mentions, is people thinking that extra practice...
Right.
Somehow
they're not.
The answer.
Why aren't they practicing more? This is also an interesting one. Again, logistically, I love that. Right. They're going back home. Today's an off day. I'm just telling you, no matter what the situation is, major leaguers, especially at this point in the season, they are not coming in on the off day. It is not happening.
Books says, does anyone think it's funny that the O's have two different Sotos on their squad and neither of them is Juan? I don't know if that's like funny.
I mean, it is a reminder that LeVon Soto's on the roster, so I appreciate that.
He's looked really good.
Okay.
These look really good. Christian says, don't care, Ravens on.
I want this. I like this one from Scott.
He says, don't care, Ravens on. But then someone else says, y'all playing like the Ravens, who are 0-2.
Ooh, so double, you're getting the double whammy there. It's that you, the Ravens are bad, but also you'd rather watch the Ravens. So that's tough. Scott says, goodness, well, you did score two runs. Probably looked around and thought, that's a lot, forgetting that other teams score more than that routinely. Fire your hitting coaches.
Firing your hitting coach on September 16th is like the funniest thing I've ever heard. Enough about the Orioles. Let's talk about another team trying to be the worst team in baseball history. Chicago White Sox, who have given themselves a chance, taking 2 out of 3 over the Oakland A's over the weekend. Their first series win since the fall of the Ottoman Empire. Kudos to them. That changes the pace. They are now 35 and 115. 35 and 115. Not good. Okay.
Still very bad.
Good. However, if they can go 6-6 over their final 12 games, if they can play 500 baseball over their final 6 games, which are Angels, Padres, and Tigers.
Angels.
Against the Angels. They have 6 against the Angels. Yes. Just sweep them. Just
West Coast them trip starts today at the Angels, 3 at the Angels, 3 in San Diego, back home for 3 against the Angels, and then 3 in Detroit.
So, again,
the worst team ever by win percentage in the modern era is the 1962 Mets. They went 40-120, so they did not play 162 games. By win percentage, if the White Sox can get to 41 wins, they will have, even though they will still have more losses, there'll be 121 losses, it'll be a better winning percentage. The, as we know, the 2003 Tigers had 43 wins. So that's looking basically impossible.
Yeah.
But prove me wrong. Again, 6 against the Angels. I guess it is in play when you look at the lineups the Angels are rolling out there. I am not anticipating a lot of runs being scored in those 6 games between these lineups. But White Sox, It's in play. And just to mention, their first series win since they took 2 out of 3 against the Rockies before, which again, the second worst team in baseball.
Which was
the Nationals was their last series win before that. That was in May.
May.
So, and then before that, it was when they took 3 of 4 against Cleveland in May. So since the beginning of May, they had 3 series wins there against the Nationals, the Rockies, and the A's.
Look,
is special season. It's a special season.
I have decided.
Yeah.
I am rooting for the White Sox to dodge history. We will remember this team forever, no matter what, right? Yes. For all the wrong reasons.
Yes.
However, if they can get hot late at the right time,
right?
Hot into October, okay? They get hot going into October, and they can just dodge it by a game and go 6-6 over the last 12. I mean, that's the stuff that stories are made of.
Well, and again, as I just said, like, the theme is they can only win series against the worst teams in the league.
And they Angels have 6 are right against
there.
The Angels.
They got it's right there for you. It's right. It's
here's the recipe.
As Aaron Boone would say, it's right there. Slam the table. Sizemore, it's right in front of us. 41 wins right in front of us.
It's right in front of us. You just take 2 out of 3 against the Angels, and you take 1 against the Pods and 1 against the Tigers.
1 against the Padres. By the way, Padres, gotta sweep. Gotta sweep it.
They won't. They won't. They can't. I said this on Ben and Woods when I went on San Diego Radio. I was like, you guys are going to lose that series to the White Sox. It's going to be hilarious. More thing before we throw it into turbo mode. Yes. First time for everything.
Oh,
there
my
is
gosh.
A first time for everything.
It happened.
Hilliot Ramos.
Yes.
Going yard.
Yes.
Opposite field in San Francisco for the first ever splash hit into McCovey Cove by a right-handed hitter in the 24-year history of the stadium. Think about how many great, legendary, right-handed sluggers have stepped up to that plate and have not dispatched a ball into the wetness until yesterday when Ramos, his team down a run in the ninth, took a pitch on the outer half.
What a spot.
Solo shot down the line, wind howling out apparently, gets it into the cove. This is something we have talked about for a long time. Who would be the first to do it? I thought it would be Pete. Some people thought it would be Judge or Stanton. It was not.
Hey, could have been Arson Judge, but alas, Arson was ready to make this happen.
Put the fire
John
into the water.
Was seeing it, he was like, it has to be him. It has to be Judge. Yeah, I mean, listen, right-handed hitters, this is not where they go to hit home runs in San Francisco. So while the Giants themselves have not had very many impressive right-handed power hitters in the last 25 years, plenty more have come through. And so it is shocking that it has never happened. And apparently not even in batting practice. Again, this is something that everyone talks about. So if it had happened in batting practice, we would know about it. And here we go. It took an 100-mile-an-hour pitch from Robert Suarez. Little help there. It took some wind and Helly Ramos making it happen. So congrats to him. Very, very, very cool.
Can you explain something to me? So when you go to the Giants website, they have a list of all the splash hits.
Yes.
It appears that this was number 105 ever. So 104 lefties did it first.
Right.
Then there's a section that says other home runs into McCovey Cove.
Oh, is that that's bad. So again, you need it's got to go direct splash. So it might be ones that bounced that were notable. So like Buster Posey in the postseason hit one that basically if it didn't hit the weird chimney thing and right, probably would have done it. But again, it doesn't count. Yeah. You got to go to direct splash. So
but
I don't know if
not
that's
on this
there.
List.
Yeah. So I don't know. You got to ask the Giants historians. Oh,
sorry. This is fascinating. This is what it is. The splash hit list is just Giants.
Oh, so they're keeping the non. So it's been more
other
than 100.
Home runs into McCovey Cove is just non Giants.
Okay. I thought they listed
that's
all of them
stupid.
On the same page. I swear they used to.
I
so maybe
that.
They've changed that. But
what? It's not as splashy because they're wearing a different uniform?
No,
Max Muncy says go get it out of the ocean.
Yeah, I was going to say. Speaking of Max Muncy, just a fun fact here, because I'm currently looking at the most home runs ever hit by a right-handed hitter at this ballpark, so ever. Buster Posey, number one, by a lot, with 61. Only 61, okay, did Buster Posey hit in this stadium. Madison Bumgarner is tied for 23rd on this list.
And he was a pitcher.
He's tied with Matt Chapman and Nolan Arenado.
For now.
So that for now. Anyway, congratulations to Helly Ramos. All right, let's fly through the rest of these.
Let me throw it in turbo mode. Three,
go for it.
Two, and one. The Rockies take 2 out of 3 over the Cubs in Coors, effectively ending the Cubs' postseason and chances. They are now 5 back in the wild card race. Good try. Good effort. We'll see you next year. Royals. Big last couple of weeks here for the Rockies, who could make the Dodgers' life very uncomfortable. Wouldn't that be hilarious? Royals 2 out of 3 over the Pirates. Royals are going to make the playoffs. What a world. Pirates win on Roberto Clemente Day, which was on Sunday. A lot of cool tributes for the Hall of Fame outfielder. Astros sweep the Angels. Jordan, go pull up the Angels lineup from Saturday just very quickly, and then you could just read those names off, and I'll tell you who I've heard of. The important thing, I guess, from this one, besides the Astros winning 3 games, Justin Verlander was meh. Again, we are now reaching a point where there is a real conversation. Will he get a playoff start? I brought this up a couple weeks ago. Maybe I was being premature, but there is a legitimate chance he does not.
He did win, though. He did win.
He did get a win.
We're making still. If you're not beating the Angels with the lineup with players that include Eric Wagaman, Jordan Adams, Jack Lopez, and Bryce Teodosio pinch running, then you're really never getting to 300. But this was at least a much needed dub for Verlander after a while.
Nico Cavadas and his 651 OPS sitting there nice and pretty in the 4-hole. I'm rooting for that guy. Blue Jays sweep the Cardinals. What?
Cardinals.
Toronto making up ground on Tampa for 4th. They're 1 game behind that 4th spot, which is funny. I think about the Premier League and how at the end of the season in soccer, it's like, oh, Everton have a shot to raise up to 11th. And like, people care about that. They
right.
Do.
Anything,
like,
it's like, anything between, 6th and 15th is basically pointless. But in the Premier League,
who knows? They care. So that's how I'm thinking about the Jays. First homer since June for Davis Schneider, who maybe isn't what we thought he was, or is what we thought he was, depending on what we thought of him. St. Louis is under 500. That is really bad. We thought they won the trade deadline. Turns out that doesn't exactly help you win ball games. There could be changes coming for the Cardinals in the winter. Guardians and the Rays split four games. Junior Caminero is so fun.
I was at a few of these games, and just he had three hits, three doubles on Saturday. And I mean, what a joy to just watch swing the bat in person. But
you know who could use Junior Caminero?
Cleveland, yeah. Although no, because they have Jose Ramirez at third base, and that is
Caminero's not playing shortstop.
Caminero at short, would that be worth it to have him? That is an interesting question that I will be asking around about today when I am back in Cleveland. Probably not. They'll take Rocchio's defense and Jose Ramirez, who is quietly pushing for 40-40. Hello? Jose Ramirez is unbelievable. He is the best. Stephen Kwan also dealing with some back issues. He's missed the last couple games. Hopefully he is not out for a significant amount of time, but nice for them to bounce back after dropping those first two. They have four against the Twins this week. I will be there for most of those games. Very important. And the Royals play the Tigers. So AL Central remains in the spotlight.
And the Nats take 3 out of 4 over the Marlins. They're better than Miami. That's good. James Wood, a couple fun home runs for him. He's going to be good. I will see the Nats today. They are here for 3, and then the Phillies are here for 4. I'm going to go to baseball games 7 days in a row.
All right. I'm back.
I'm married. Okay, and I'm ready to go.
All right. Well, so we will be at the ballpark a bunch this week. And this was a good Monday recap. Anything else?
Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Before we go, clap it up for the Baseball Barbacast fantasy football team who took their first victory.
Oh, baby.
Over the weekend.
We are back to 1-1. We have, like the Red Sox, we're back at 500 where we belong.
If the White Sox play like us, they'll be fine.
You just got to play like Marvin Harrison Jr., 27 fantasy points. That looks like a lot. That looks like a lot. So there you go. Anyway, there it is. Thank you all for listening. We will be back on Wednesday. See ya.
Every time we beat a football podcast, my heart grows.